I just want to give you a little bit of an update this afternoon. As of this morning, there have been 291 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Hillsborough County, including three deaths and 51 hospitalizations. Yesterday, we had a 92-year-old female that a resident of Hillsborough County that passed away from COVID-19. And this was the third confirmed death of coronavirus in Hillsborough. And our thoughts and prayers go out to her family and her loved ones. We need everyone to take this very, very seriously. You have heard me say this day in and day out. And we need everyone to stay at home, if at all possible, and to practice social distancing at all times. 6 feet away at all times, and again, taking those simple steps to prevent contracting or giving anyone the coronavirus. So critically, critically important. And by staying home, you can save your life, you can save the life of a loved one, or those individuals that are in the high-risk category. So it really is a life or death issue. And your personal responsibility is to take this seriously, stay at home, and practice social distancing. Very, very important. Hillsborough County, the testing site out at Raymond James Stadium, as many of you are aware, received 1,000 collection kits, and they tested for 3 days and used all, but I believe 41 of those collection kits were able to obtain 1,000 more collection kits last Friday, and then 500 additional collection kits. So 1,541. They have opened up, Hillsborough County has opened up the hotline to make appointments. You have to be triaged first, and then you'll be given a number, and you can go out to the Raymond James Stadium location and be tested. The collection kit will be sent off for testing. The number that you can call if you're experiencing symptoms is 813-272-5900. And again, you'll be pre-screened and pre-registered. So very, very important that you call ahead, because those supplies are very limited with the 1,500 collection kits, but also the PPE that they're using. The call center will be taking appointments now through Thursday, April 2nd from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. And they plan to start doing the actual collections tomorrow morning. So that's Wednesday morning out at Raymond James Stadium. Now, it is my pleasure and actually my honor to be able to introduce to you Dr. Lockwood. He is the Dean of the USF Health Morsani College of Medicine and the College of Nursing, Public Health, and Pharmacy. He's also served as an executive vice president at Tampa General since 2015, and he has been an incredible source of knowledge throughout this this event, and actually in other dealing with other issues as well. And we were talking earlier, and he said that he never says no, and I can attest to that, because whenever I call him and I ask him a question, or I ask if he would be interested in participating in events, he always says yes. So he is here to give us some updates and some information and just really fascinating facts about COVID-19 and this virus. So first, I would like to ask you, Dr. Lockwood, about the importance of social distancing.
Yeah. Well, the virus is really spread by what are called respiratory droplets. So that is basically the droplets that are created when you sneeze or cough. So if you're more than 6 feet away, as we are, the respiratory droplets will not reach you, and you won't acquire the infection that way. Now, there are other ways that you can get infected. Contaminated surfaces are one, but the primary mechanism is through respiratory droplets, and so that's why social distancing is so important.
Mm-hmm. And it'll be very interesting as well, as we go along, we'll be able to actually determine the impact that social distancing has on the spread of the virus. And as we've all heard, that terminology of flattening the curve, and we'll be able to find out that those locations, those cities, those counties, those states that implemented the social distancing practice early on will probably be a lot more successful in reducing those cases.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll know in about 2 weeks. So the cases that are diagnosed usually were a result of an infection that happened 2 weeks before. So you have to start measuring the benefits of social distancing after about 2 weeks. So we still have a little ways to go, but we're getting there. And, you know, fortunately, we began social distancing early enough in our epidemic that I think we're going to benefit here in Hillsborough County a lot more than, for example, poor New York did, where they delayed it. And of course, they started the epidemic much earlier there than we did. So I'm counting on that being a major factor in helping us avoid, you know, the catastrophic outcomes that New York has seen.
That's great. So everybody that's frustrated about being at home, just think about that. The reward comes in 2 weeks. Doesn't mean we'll be able to end it, but we'll be able to see the benefit of that and hopefully the flattening of the curve here in Hillsborough County. So what effect has the lag in testing had on this virus spread? Because as we've seen across the nation, we've seen here, but across the nation as well, is that we don't have the collections swabs. We don't have the PPE for our first responders. There's a lot of delays in the testing ability because of the sheer volume, lack of machines, all of that. So just talk about that a little bit, the lag in testing for the virus.
So the big problem we have with this epidemic is that it's the first epidemic that we have diagnosed or identified as a result of testing for what's called nucleic acid, or in this case, the RNA of the virus. Normally, when you have an epidemic, for example, Zika, we would measure in your blood whether you had antibodies, and that would tell us whether you were infected or not. We might also measure the viral RNA to tell us that you were infectious at that moment. But in this case, we've only identified the viral RNA. So we're only detecting patients that are actively infected, that are shedding the virus. The problem with that is that there are a lot of people that already had the infection that are better, that may have been infectious earlier, and we didn't recognize that. And so they may be infecting people or had infected people previously that we're not aware of. The second problem with this method of testing is that we don't have enough kits. So we're only identifying and only testing patients that are very sick or that have significant risk factors. So they have a fever, they have cough, they might be over 65 and have diabetes or heart disease or high blood pressure or lung disease, or they're hospitalized. And so the number of patients we're identifying is much smaller than the number of people that are infected. And it's also leading to an exaggeration of the mortality rate. So right now in the United States, we're showing a mortality rate of about 1.8%. That's really high. That's many, many, 20 times higher than the flu. The problem is that the number, the denominator, is much smaller than we really is. Mm-hmm. So if we were to be actively testing everybody, we would have a much larger number of cases and a much smaller case fatality rate. And if we were to include antibody testing of the folks that already had the infection and are now better, that denominator would be even larger and the case fatality rate would be even lower. So the good news is it's not as lethal as we think. And based on data from China and elsewhere, we think that the mortality rate is probably closer to about 0.6%, not 1.8%. That's still three times higher than a bad flu, and so it's really bad, but it's not Ebola, it's not, you know, a absolutely horrendous epidemic. But all that also means that a lot of folks are infected that we don't know are infected, and a lot of folks had been infected and infected other people, and we don't know about that. So that's created a real problem with trying to get a handle on the disease, trying to identify the folks that are at risk, and keep them out of the, you know, have them isolated. And it's one of the reasons it spreads so fast. We just don't know who's infected. And so from a practical standpoint, for the folks at home, assume everybody is infected and keep your distance and assume every surface you touch is infected in public and make sure you wash your hands frequently. Wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water, warm water, and 20 seconds is a long time to wash your hands, so you have to sing Happy Birthday to Me twice. That's 20 seconds. Use hand sanitizer. That's also very effective. But assume that public surfaces are infected and assume that everybody you meet is infected. And if you assume that, you probably won't get infected. So does that mm-hmm. kind of answer the
yeah,
question?
That's very good. And I just want to warn you too, if I sing Happy Birthday to you twice, it's going to seem like a lot longer than 20 seconds because I can't carry a tune. But with so one of the things that points that you brought up, I think is fascinating. So within the realm of health professionals, what is a percentage of individuals that you feel may have contracted this virus and really have no idea that they had it? Is there?
So in China, that was studied, and it turned out that 86% of people that were infected were undocumented. So they had either very mild symptoms or no symptoms, but they were still infectious. They were about half as infectious as the folks that had fever and cough and shortness of breath, but they are infectious. But we really are probably underestimating significantly the number of people that have had the infection or are better mm-hmm. or that have the infection right now.
That to me is fascinating. 86% of, you know, of all of the American public will get it somewhere in that.
Well, we're not saying that, but we're saying mm-hmm. that for every 14 people that have it, there's probably another 86 that we don't know about that also
that
have it.
Right, exactly. Okay. So with that said, you and I have had a discussion about the significance of testing for the antibodies. Number one, you know, we could get individuals who may have had this virus and not have any idea they had it, and now they have the antibodies and therefore immune to it, and they could help with those that are in the high risk. You know, the medical professionals could go into the hospitals or into the nursing homes and help there, or just individuals could go back to work if they actually had the antibodies. So what about that test?
So that's really important. And once we have the antibody test available and in great numbers, initially we'll probably have to measure both the viral RNA and the antibodies to show that people have the antibody and they don't have the virus, so they're mm-hmm. immune, they can't get infected again, they're not going to infect anybody, and yes, they can go back to work and they can really, they're fine and they can mm-hmm. do whatever they need to do. And that would be particularly helpful, as you say, with first responders, with nurses and docs on the front line, but ultimately Subway, people that run Subways or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, submarine sandwiches, whatever they want, they can go back to work. And that'll be the first group that goes back to work. Then as we do a better and better job of identifying folks at risk, social distancing, the what we call the R value, the reproductive number of the virus, begins to drop below one, meaning that every one person is infecting less than one person, then we really have a handle on the virus and we can start to bring back the folks that haven't been infected but are young and healthy and not at risk for mortality, and that'll be the second tranche of folks that go back to work. And then as the virus becomes rare, the more vulnerable folks over 65 or mm-hmm. with comorbidities, then they can go back to work. So, you know, there will be an ending to this epidemic. I think we will start to see people going back to work that are immune within probably 4 to 8 weeks. I think we'll start to see the healthy folks that haven't been infected go back to work in probably 8 to 12 weeks. I'm making these numbers up, but mm-hmm. I think they're pretty close. And then probably in about 4 months, the more vulnerable folks will probably be able to go back to work. You have to watch for recurrence in the fall, mm-hmm. But we should be much better able to control the infection in the fall because we will have far fewer infections, a lot of people will be immune, and we'll be able to really track and trace contacts and keep them out of the population so other folks don't get infected. So, you know, I do see light at the end of the tunnel. Yeah. I think that we have been lucky here in Hillsborough County that we haven't had more cases, that the rate of infection is much slower than it is in other areas, including Miami-Dade and Broward and mm-hmm. Palm Beach. But we can't slack off. We have to be very vigilant, social distancing, mm-hmm. hand washing, assume everybody's infected, assume every surface is infected.
Okay. Now, before we open it up for questions, can you just talk about the re-emergence? I don't want to say resurgence. That sounds like it's going to hit us like a, you know, another tidal wave. But for this to come back in the fall, sometime in the fall yeah. to...
So if you look at where the infection is now, it's in the Northern Hemisphere, and it's in a fairly narrow belt in the Northern Hemisphere. So as you go further south, particularly sunny, warmer areas, there's less infection. That's one of the reasons Florida is not New York. But it's still a relatively rare disease in South America and Africa. It's occurring, but at much lower rates. Well, and that's because people are outdoors there, it's summer there, it's warm, it's humid. But as the epidemic begins to decline here, it'll pick up there. And then when we start to get cold again in the Northern Hemisphere, the virus will reemerge. Mm-hmm. So we have to be very vigilant about travel from those areas. We have to be testing people. We will soon be able to test people probably at the airport to be able to ensure that we're not letting infected people in. And then we'll have much better testing capability and capacity to identify folks at risk. And then by the fall, we'll also have probably two or three different classes of medications and therapies that we don't have currently. So I'm not terribly nervous about the fall, but I do expect it to recur to a certain degree mm-hmm. in the fall.
Okay. Now, I said that was going to be the last question, but the one there's been a lot of talk about the ability for the virus to survive in higher temperatures. Is it more that it's not down in the southern areas as much as the northern hemisphere right now because we're not as in close proximity or because it's warmer?
Well, it's probably UV light. More than anything else. So the sunlight is a great disinfectant, and the virus degrades very quickly under UV light. In fact, that's one of the things we're starting to think about doing to make sure that we have enough personal protective equipment is to expose it to UV light. So part of it's UV light, part of it is people are outside. There's some evidence with other coronaviruses. Remember, the coronaviruses cause 25% of colds. It's an incredibly common virus. Mm. This is a version that is much more dangerous than the common cold, but it is a coronavirus, so there is at least some expectation that there's seasonality and that as we get into the summer months, the rate of infection will drop. Well, in South America and in Africa, they are in their summer period right now.
Okay, fascinating. All right, let's open it up to questions. Some of the questions that we have had that were sent in earlier. Is it possible to have allergy symptoms and no fever to test positive for COVID-19? That's from Jamie Black on Facebook.
Well, so it is possible because a lot of folks that have it don't have any symptoms or mm-hmm. mild symptoms. But it turns out that cold-like symptoms, so runny nose, sore throat, kind of upper respiratory tract symptoms are pretty rare with COVID. COVID is a lower respiratory tract infection. Mm-hmm. So fever is present in, we think, the vast majority. We say 99%, but it's probably more like 80 to 90% of patients. And dry cough, about 60% of patients. And shortness of breath, about 30% of patients. So if you have hay fever symptoms, you have hay fever.
Okay, makes sense. All right, based on the current data available, when do you anticipate that Florida will peak? This is from Katrina Latinka on Facebook.
Hard to know exactly, and there are different models out there, but the best estimates are early May. Now, the good news is we are locking down more and more of the state, particularly mm-hmm. the areas that are at greatest risk. So I think that peak is going to be a lot lower than it was in New York or Detroit or New Orleans or you know, a number of the other, Chicago, some of the other affected areas. So I'm anticipating probably early May, it could be late April, but I'm not anticipating anywhere near the peak that, particularly in Hillsborough County, that we see up north.
Now, what are your observations with New Orleans? They basically blamed their outbreak on the Mardi Gras festivities and the close proximity there. What effect do you think that the spring break festivities would have? I saw a heat map the other day where they tracked cell phone data for individuals that were at Fort Lauderdale and had basically taken it all over the Northeast.
Yeah. Well, of course, a lot of them end up back north mm-hmm. And out of the state. So as a Floridian, that's not so bad, but as an American, that's not good. So there is the opportunity for spread. I mean, the biggest risk the state has right now is of travel between Miami and particularly, I would say really Palm Beach, Broward, and Dade, and New York. And there's just a lot of New Yorkers that come down, and New Yorkers obviously have a much higher rate of infection than anyone else in the country. So I'm really worried about mm-hmm. those three counties. And I think that obviously the governor has taken steps, and the mayors and county commissioners have taken steps to really lock down those areas, and I think appropriately so. But that in the state of Florida, that's the area I'm most concerned about.
Okay. All right. I think we already answered the heat and humidity. Does that kill the virus? How long does the virus linger in the air and on surfaces? That's from Spencer via Twitter.
Yeah, so that's a great question. We thought we knew the answer. And so there was a New England Journal article a couple of weeks ago that suggested on cardboard 24 hours, so when you get cardboard surfaces, wipe them off. On stainless steel and plastic, about 3 days. Mm. Now, aerosol is, we think, much faster, probably 3 hours. The problem is that there was a study done in the Diamond Princess cruise boat that suggested that it could stay on the surfaces there for 17 days. Now, no one else has shown that. That seems to be specific mm-hmm. to cruise ships. And it may have to do with recirculating of their air and some other factors. I think the key point here is assume any public surface that's frequently touched, door handles, elevator buttons, and so forth, are infected. And if you're going to touch them without a glove or a Kleenex, wipe your hands, wash your hands, use hand sanitizer. Cannot emphasize that enough.
Okay, excellent. You may have just killed the cruise industry.
Yeah, well, and disinfect surfaces as much as you can. When you're using a keyboard, wipe mm-hmm. it down to start with. Wipe it down when you're done. Assume every surface is infected. Someday the cruise industry will come back.
Well, no doubt.
But not right now.
Right, no doubt about that. And as you said, assume everyone has it, and that's sort of my mantra too. I say, assume you have it, and take every step possible to keep from spreading it. Okay, while awaiting COVID-19 test results, are there any safe medications that help with the symptoms? And that's from Nicholas on Facebook.
So for sure, Tylenol is safe. There was some concern about non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like Motrin, mm-hmm. aspirin, and so forth. I think the bulk of the evidence suggests that they're safe as well. I would definitely recommend Tylenol, though, for fever. And you can use cough medicine for cough. But again, you're looking for rapid deterioration. If you get short of breath, if your fever is getting very high, mm-hmm. make sure you're staying in touch with your provider. Really important, because this disease is very unpredictable. Most people have very minimal symptoms, but then other folks are dying. So if you're rapidly deteriorating, make sure that you are in constant contact with your provider so they can get you into the hospital and get appropriate care.
Without a doubt. I read that USF Health is printing 3D nasal swabs for COVID-19 and that it is possible to produce up to 3,000 a day. Are you at that level of production? Where are these swabs going once printed, produced from Paul Kamur?
So we're making our own collection kits. We've collected, we can create the viral transport medium they call VTM, using a recipe that the CDC suggested. So we produced that, we validated it, it works, it collects the viral RNA, it's perfectly useful. And our problem was not enough of the swabs were available, because the company that makes the swabs, the bulk of swabs in this country, is located in northern Italy, and needless to say, that's not a good place to be manufacturing these days. So we decided, well, what the heck, we would make our own using this 3D printer. So we went through a variety of different formulas, and Summer Decker at USF really led this project, and she did an amazing job. And this seems to be as effective, certainly as effective as the commercially available swabs, at collecting the virus. It actually is more comfortable. So the way the FDA regulates these devices is that we can use it at USF, at Tampa General, at the VA, at our affiliates, and we may also be able to give it to the state. So right now we're using it locally. We potentially may give some of these to the Department of Health. We have to make sure that that's okay with the FDA, we're pretty sure that it is, but we can't sell them, and we can't give them to people that aren't one of those entities. Mm-hmm. But we have given the formula out to many, many other hospitals, also who have 3D printers, and they're starting to manufacture them too. So, for example, in New York, Northwell Health System in Long Island is manufacturing huge numbers, and they're using it as part of their collection kit. So this is, I think, our goal here is to make sure that anybody that can print these prints them and helps relieve that shortage.
Okay, so if we catch up with the collection swabs, what are some of the other roadblocks?
So that's the first roadblock. The second bottleneck is not enough of the reagent to run the assay. And the third bottleneck is not enough of the machines to run the assay. So the manufacturers of those reagents and the CDC are trying to ramp that up. We're still way behind. The commercial labs like LabCorp and Quest still have a big lag of somewhere between 3 and 7 days before they give us their results. So we really need to catch up. Now, Abbott has a very rapid assay, and that's being scaled up, and that should be available in the next couple of weeks. So I think we'll be over that hump relatively quickly, but it is still a major problem in dealing with this epidemic.
Good, good. Do you think that it's more important to focus, or is it, it shouldn't be a question, to focus on the testing or on the antibody?
So both. Okay. I think it's really important that right now we have the nucleic acid, the RNA test that tells us the patient's actively infected, because we act on that information. Mm-hmm. But over time, we're going to want to know who was infected and is better, because that's the group that can go back to work. Okay. And it'll also tell us how many people actually had the infection. So that's going to be really valuable information, because it'll tell us that denominator again. What's the real case fatality rate here? So it's going to be really useful information. I think the antibody test will roll out over the next 3 weeks, and we should be at scale in about a month.
Okay, with that, how long do you think it will be before a vaccine is made available? And that's Danilo Connor on Facebook.
Yeah, so normally I would say 18 months, because that's about how long it takes. But there is enormous pressure being brought to bear on all the potential manufacturers of the vaccine. And I have a pretty good guess that it's going to be less than a year, or about a year.
Okay, good, good. And then I think you've answered this, but once you've had COVID-19 and recovered, can you get it again a second time from Janet Long?
Yeah, so we are pretty sure that that you are cured and that you won't get it again. There may be a tiny group of patients that keep shedding the virus after mm-hmm. they have the antibody, but we think that's going to be a small number. We need to prove that. So initially, before we send people back to the workforce, we'll probably want to test for the viral RNA and the antibody. And if they have the antibodies and they don't have the viral RNA, then they can go back to work. But eventually, I think we'll be comfortable enough that we'll know that the vast majority of folks with antibodies, particularly those that have both classes of antibodies, IgM and IgG, or just IgG, which means you had an infection a while ago, will be good to go and go back to work. And from what's occurred in China, we're pretty confident that people don't get reinfected and they are cured once they make antibodies. But we do need some a little bit of more additional data there.
And what's the testing process for those antibodies? I mean, for the virus, you get the nasal and the throat swab.
So this is a blood test.
Okay.
It might just be a finger prick with an assay that you do, a quick assay that you do, that will tell us whether you have the antibodies, yes or no. The blood test will tell us the level of antibody that you have.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much. Let's see. So I know that you and I talked about this as well earlier, but it says if you have no symptoms, how do you know if you're a carrier of COVID-19 and how long would you carry it for? That's Alice Valdez on Facebook.
Well, assume you are, because that's
there
the safest thing to do. But the average time of between an infection and showing symptoms is 5 days. About 95% of patients will show evidence of the infection within 7 days, and 99% within 14 days. So clearly, if you're 14 days out and you have no symptoms, you're either cured or you never had it. And you're probably good to go either way. And that's why we use the 14-day isolation period, because you're really pretty confident that you either didn't have it or, as I say, you may have had it, and you're all better.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lockwood.
No problem.
Fascinating as always. I tell you, I could talk to you for forever, but that then all of our audience would fall asleep. But really, thank you for all you've done for our community well, and we really appreciate it. Before we leave, I have to ask everyone to take out your phone right now and text Tampa Ready to 888-777. And for Spanish speakers, Tampa Lista, same number, 888-777. And to get real-time text information in addition to COVID-19 and information on that, if you're a small business owner, text Tampa Biz to the same number, 888-777. And we're putting out information on the relief that is coming from the state, financial relief, and also from the federal government. We were on a conference call with Congresswoman Kathy Castor yesterday, and we walked through all of those funding streams that are being made available. And we are working here on a number of fronts in the city of Tampa to help our community, those individuals that have lost their jobs, and those individuals that have small businesses and are suffering right now. So we're taking steps to ensure that we are there for you to help you regardless of what that need is. And if you have questions that you need to talk to somebody, we have call takers standing by who can answer your questions in English or Spanish. And that is at 833-TPA-INFO. Once a cop, always a cop. 833-TPA-INFO. And then for the testing, it is 813-272-5900. All right, everybody be safe and what? Stay at home. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Lockwood.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Charles Lockwood from the USF Morsani College of Medicine, guest of Mayor Jane Castor in Tampa this afternoon.